Well, you're listening to Garden Talk on The Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Najel. Our good friend Lisa Johnson is back with us. She's a UW Extension horticulture educator for Dane County. We'll start out by talking about what damage that we can expect from our recent weather patterns. And then, of course, we'll take all your other gardening questions. So give us a call, 800-642-1234, or you can send an email to talk at WPR.org. Lisa, welcome back.
Thanks. Great to be back.
It's always good to have you here because you can pretty much answer any question that we throw at you. So I'm challenging everybody to come up with a question that'll stump Lisa. No, I'm kidding. So I lost a number of shrubs in particular this last winter. That seems to be the case for a lot of people.
Yeah, unfortunately. And we've heard of people losing newly planted shrubs, established shrubs, different species of shrubs, also, of course, perennials, and damage to marginally hardy species like Japanese maple. So, yeah, it was bad, and it was mostly due to a combination of not having enough snow and not having it when we had some really cold temperatures, so the cold penetrated into the ground and killed roots, especially if you were in the upper central part of the state. They recorded some really cold temperatures at 8 inches, 4 inches, and 8 inches down. We do have something, if you're interested in finding out what the soil temperature is at 4 inches and 8 inches down, if you go to the state climatology website, they have something called WiscoNet, and that has weather stations from around the state. And they do have soil temperatures, one of the things that includes. And last year, that was really important when we were tracking cicada emergence, because we wanted to know, 4 inches down, what's the temperature? When are they coming?
So you said
not with that this year.
No. WiscoNet.net?
Yeah,
is it?
WiscoNet.
WiscoNet. Okay. I'm sure if you just, put it in your search engine, you should be able to find it. I didn't realize that we kept track of ground soil temperatures, but it makes a lot of sense, doesn't it?
Yeah. Particularly if you're growing something like alfalfa, that you want it to survive the winter. And of course, for our trees and shrubs and other things, it's good to know. If it gets to 20 or below, even underground, that can damage and freeze roots. What did you lose in terms of shrubs?
Let's see. I lost a dogwood. I lost a couple of hydrangeas. And then another one that I can't remember what it is and never will know now. But I was really heartbroken, and I lost some roses. And my lavender plant, which has survived for the last 4 or 5 winters, and it succumbed this year. So, yeah, it was nasty. And that happens because we not only get frost, but then we thaw too, right?
Yeah, we had freeze and thaw events, no snow, and to insulate us from any of that. So. Just really, really bad. I work at a greenhouse part-time during the spring, and we were getting all kinds of people coming in with all kinds of sad stories about things that they'd lost. And it's, grief counselors at this point.
Well, and not only do we love our plants, but they're not exactly cheap. And so, you put all this money into it. And it's really sad. What are your suggestions? So I have 3 hydrangeas, 2 of them died. I've got one left, but it's, in pretty good shape. Am I never going to have hydrangeas that catch up with that one? Or do I just have to replant those and be patient?
Did you lose a lot of tissue above ground?
For the one that came back?
The survivor?
No, actually, and the rabbits left alone, which is kind of a shocker to me. I'm not sure what happened with that. But so right now it's, it's probably about 2 feet high. So it's doing pretty well.
Okay. Do you know what kind of hydrangea?
I think it might have been little quick fire.
Okay. All right. So it's a panicle hydrangea that blooms later in the year. Those are pretty tough and resilient. So I'm pretty sure that will eventually get to the same size that it was. If it was a big leaf hydrangea, like any of the, I'm losing it. The blue and pink flowering ones.
Mm-hmm.
I can't think of the endless summer. That's it.
Endless.
The endless summer types, twist and shout, lace cap ones. Those you might have more damage on because they're less hardy.
Okay. So it's a wait and see thing. I mean, at that time, this time is where the middle of June, basically. If our shrub is still not showing signs of life, can we assume that it's dead?
Yeah. And if you want to do an extra test, take your fingernail and scratch the bark. And if it is brown underneath the bark, it is toast. If it's kind of a sickly green, it may come back. If it's bright green, then you still have a chance.
Okay. All right. Well, good luck to everybody who's got one of those in-between plants. Let's go to the phones right now. We've got Walter in Barron County who has a question for you. Go ahead, Walter.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I'm calling about my garden. I have like a 20 by 30 foot garden. And last year I planted a lot of seeds and some tomato plants, some pepper plants, and none of the seeds came up. And the plants just stayed the same. Same thing happened this year, and I'm not sure what's wrong. None of the seeds have come up except some peas that I planted way on the side where I've never planted before. So is this kind of, I wasted all the seeds and plants and none of it is growing.
That's a shame.
Yeah, that is a shame. And that's odd. And you hadn't had problems in that area before.
No, I have not. I've actually planted there from like 15 years before that and never had any problem. And these last 2 years, it's just like nothing.
Wow. And what kinds of seed are you planting and how old were the seeds?
Oh, they're new seeds. I ordered them from Young Seed Catalog. So they're new. They're not old. Both years. They're current seeds.
What species?
What type of plants? Well, tomato plants and pepper plants I bought, and they just stayed the same. And the seeds that I bought were carrots and beans. And onions, and that's about it. But a lot of some pepper seeds as well.
Okay, and you were germinating the peppers and tomatoes outside?
Well, I bought the plants.
You bought them
and planted them, right?
Okay, got it. So you started them outside, inside, and then you planted them. Outside?
No,
or are you saying the ones?
And tomato plants and just planted them in the ground this year and last year. And I've done it every year before and they've always grown.
So what are they looking like right now? Is it just that they haven't gotten any taller or are they looking different in any way?
Same from when I bought them at the nursery.
They're the same size.
So, yeah, they have not grown at all. They didn't die, but they haven't grown at all. They're just the same size.
What's your weather been like up in Barron County?
It's been cool and kind of rainy and wet.
Okay. The thing with peppers and tomatoes is if they are put out and it is below 50 degrees, so if it's in the 40s, it can stunt their growth. And that might be an explanation for what's going on with them. But that doesn't explain what's going on with the seeds. I'm assuming you planted them at the regular time and that the soil was at a good temperature.
Yeah, I've planted them in mid-May every year for like 15 years or so. and he left years. It's completely different. None of the seeds came up except the peas, like I told you. So really don't know what's wrong. Is there some kind of problem with the soil all of a sudden? I don't get it.
That's what I was wondering, and after I crossed off a bunch of other possibilities with you here.
Should he get his soil tested, Lisa?
The thing is that it's hard to test for disease in soil. And there are a few types that Brian at the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic can test for. What I would do is I would get a hold of him and ask explain what happened and see if there's anything that he can test. Usually he'd need like a diseased plant to be able to test for the pathogen. I'm not sure that the type of technology he has there can pick up something like Fusarium or Verticillium wilt or Phytophthora in the soil without it actually being in plant material. But that's the next stop that I would make in trying to figure this out.
Okay, Walter. So try the disease lab, UW disease, plant disease lab, and you should be able to find that information. Good luck.
EDDC.
Yeah. Okay. Thanks, Walter. Good luck. That's got to be so frustrating. My goodness. Yeah, I didn't.
And he stumped me first thing.
Yeah. Oh, thanks. Thanks, Walter. But now, if there is some kind of disease in his soil and he does figure out what it is, does he have to then get rid of that soil? I mean, what do you do when that happens?
Yeah, well, it partly depends on the disease. There are some diseases that stay in the soil a long time and are fatal to a lot of things. There are other diseases that will, you know, if you're rotating your crops, would go away. It's the thing that bothers me is that he's got so many different plant families that he mentioned. And I just, you know, usually if it's a mass failure like that, your guess is there's something wrong with the seed, which it shouldn't be because it's new seed. Or there's something wrong with the soil or the temperature of the soil when things were planted. Mm-hmm. And I don't know what the, at the time of planting, what the soil temperature was, but a lot of, crops have a minimum, and it, of course it varies by species, a minimum temperature for germination and an optimum. But you would think at least a few seeds.
Yeah, that's very strange. So
that's why I'm thinking it may be the soil. And what would have happened from last year to this year? I guess one question I could have asked was if he had added put in a mulch of, for example, lawn grass that might have been treated with herbicide, or possibly gotten some manure from somewhere that might have also been treated with something.
That's a very good point. Okay, we are talking with Lisa Johnson. She's a UW Extension Horticulture Educator for Dane County. What questions do you have? Give us a call. We do have a couple of lines still open, 800-642-1234. And of course, you can always send an email. We'll try to get to all of those, talk@wpr.org. And this is Garden Talk on the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau. Stay with us. Coming up in the last 30 minutes of the show, we'll talk about petunias that glow in the dark. But right now, we're going to go back to our phones. We've got Bev and Rhinelander with a question. Go ahead, Bev.
Hi. I've done this before, so I can't understand why I'm having a problem this year. I had some beautiful geraniums, so I decided to overwinter them. I let them go dormant, and then in the spring, repotted the root in a stem that was left, started watering, and they got very green and very lush, look very healthy looking, but there's not a bud on any of them.
You mean they haven't started flowering?
Yeah, right.
Okay.
And you're in Rhinelander, correct?
Right.
Okay. Are they outside?
They are outside now, but they were in the house for, probably 6 weeks before I put them out.
Okay. And that still shouldn't do it. Have they been fertilized?
They have.
Was it a high nitrogen fertilizer?
It was, what is it? Miracle-Gro.
Okay. Well, that shouldn't do it, but sometimes when you have a high nitrogen fertilizer, and that could be, 15% nitrogen, 20%, 30%, you will sometimes get lots of great leaves, but not any flowers. I'd say if you are not currently fertilizing with that, to hold off. And if you still don't see any flowers that are starting in a couple of weeks, depending on when you last fertilized, if it was, a couple of weeks ago, then let it go for about a month. And then I would try a higher phosphorus fertilizer, which would push flowers. But I don't know why it wouldn't work if you're using the same kind of soil and so on that you usually do, and obviously the same plants. If they look healthy otherwise, they should be flowering.
Do they maybe need,
unless it's been too cold up there for them? That is the other possibility. If it's been like in the 40s, they may not be flowering or initiating flowers for you.
Okay, Bev, good luck with that. Harry and Hayward, you are next.
Yes, thank you, and thanks for taking my call. Say, this is a gentleman that called, and he struggled with his seeds and not germinating. Up here in Hayward, I have been very successful with all of my plants. However, what I'm not doing is I'm starting everything like almonds, squashes, cucumbers, pickles. I start them all in potting soil, sterile soil that you buy and start your seeds in there. Anything I plant in the garden is treated with a fungicide, and I get excellent germination. I'm talking maybe 97%, and that is specifically like with bush beans and potatoes that are not treated, but all of those things, even the commercial applications here, all the corns, all the beans that are planted, they all have a fungicide on them, because without that, there's a fungus naturally in the soil, and you get very poor germination. However, that being said, start them inside, and you're not going to have any problems.
Okay.
That is a good point. I would caution people, though, if they're going to use fungicide on edible crops as a drench, it needs to be a product that is labeled for vegetable gardens. Otherwise, it is not safe, and it's technically breaking the law if you're, using a product in a way that it's not labeled for. So I would caution about that. I think starting plants indoors is a great idea, but obviously something like beans and your root crops, those pretty much need to be started where they're going to grow. So that's that's problematic, but I'm glad the caller has had success with growing the plants. But I'm a little leery about recommending fungicides
in general. Yeah. Okay. Thank you, Harry. We've got some emails, so let's go to. We've got an inside plant question for you. Sergio in Princeton emailed to ask for information on bromeliad plants. He has one that he got from a big box store, and the green leaves are still growing, but the flower has dried out. What can he do to bring the plant back, or is it too late? The plant has never flowered, although apparently it had it when he bought it, and it hasn't grown any pups either. They had the plant near a south-facing window, but changed it to a west-facing window that doesn't get a huge amount of direct sunlight.
Okay, so the flowers don't last forever, so it's not surprising that the flower has dried out. It can certainly be removed if it hasn't been. Also, flowering takes a lot of energy from a plant, so that's probably why it hasn't produced any pups. Depending on how long it's been since the flower died, you might not see any pups for a while. Also, if it's planted in a bigger pot, I would be careful about watering. It might be that the soil is a little, you know, staying too wet if it's in a bigger pot, because in nature, they don't necessarily have a lot of, like having a lot of wet soil around them, considering where they grow. Other than that, the light level sounds fine. It sounds like the caller is doing what should be done.
Mm-hmm.
Or emailer, I guess I should say.
Yes, the emailer, Sergio. Yeah, for sure. You've got to be patient with them. And like you said, they can rot pretty quickly. So yeah, be patient, Sergio. It'll be okay. Rowan in Madison, you are next. Go right ahead.
Hello. I'm calling about our blueberry plants. We planted them maybe a year ago?
In May.
And they have started growing little red dots all over the leaves. And some of the newer leaves are
crinkly and not really doing that well.
Okay. It sounds like a fungal disease of some kind. What you might want to do is send a good quality digital picture to Brian Huddleston at the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic. And there is a charge for him to look at it and diagnose which disease it is. If he's not able to do that from a photo, he would need a direct sample from you, and then the amount that you paid towards the digital diagnosis goes towards the physical one. But other things that I would want to check on is when you planted the plant, did you have the soil pH at the right level? Was it, did you have the soil tested, or did you add things to the soil to make it an acid pH?
What we did was made raised beds with sand under them, did a mixture of pine bark, perlite, and peat moss, and some acid fertilizer. First, then planted the blueberries. We have two Polaris, a North Blue, and a North Country.
Nice. Okay, that all sounds good. I'm sorry, did you say what part of the state you were from?
She's in Madison.
Oh, in Madison. Mm-hmm. Okay. I do want to let you know that our water source is usually alkaline. When we had blueberries at the Dane County Extension Teaching Garden, we did the same thing that you did. We had a bed that had a lot of peat moss for our blueberries and pine needles and so on. So it started out at the right pH, but because we were irrigating over time and the pH of our water was 7.5 or so, it raised the pH of the bed. So you might want to check that your pH is still where it's supposed to be. And if it's not, you want to add some type of sulfur product, whether it's iron sulfate or whether it's soil sulfur. Soil sulfur is probably the best. So if you start seeing some problems that way, but I think probably what you're talking about is a foliar disease. And I couldn't tell without looking at a picture of it exactly which one it might be, and that's more Brian's territory. So I would definitely send him a photo. Sounds like you're doing a great job, though, with your blueberries. That's awesome.
Because blueberries are not easy if you don't have the
right soil.
If you want to know more, Rowan, I know that the UW Extension Learning Store has a great pamphlet on growing blueberries, right? Lisa?
Actually, we don't.
Oh, I thought you did.
No, what we have is we have a fact sheet on growing blueberries in containers, which is by my colleague, Vijay. And that one can be found on the UW horticulture site. I do have a YouTube on growing blueberries that you can find if you just put in my name, Lisa Johnson, and blueberries in YouTube. And that will come up. But I believe it's Minnesota Extension that has a really extensive publication on growing blueberries.
Okay, lots of great information out there. Good luck, Rowan. Let's go to Bob in Madison next. Go ahead, Bob.
Hello, Joe. Yeah, the caller a little while ago asking about why his seeds didn't germinate from Barron County. In Madison, 2 years ago, last year, I had the same issue. I don't know, maybe one out of 100 bean seeds germinator came up. All I could find in the soil where I planted them was the shell on the outer coat of the bean seed. Everything was gone. What I discovered is millions, I'm assuming, of little tiny ants, maybe a 16th of an inch long, just swarming all over the. So they, what it ended up doing, I'm sure, is that they ate out the endosperm, killed the seed before it even could germinate. Wow. So you might want to check for ants in this garden.
Yeah. The other thing that can do it for beans is there's a bean seed maggot. And I've had that problem here in Madison. We have a website on vegetable entomology. That's the Russ Groves site. And he has, if you go into it, he has different insects that attack different kinds of crops, when they usually do it, and mitigation. I haven't heard of ants attacking seed before. I would think the seed would need to have been, you know, wet and so on for them to get in there and do that. But if they were all over the seed coat, it does sound a bit suspicious.
And in case you want to ask an expert entomologist, PJ Leash will be with us next Wednesday. So,
oh, that's awesome.
Yeah. So you can call in and ask him, Bob, if you'd like to see if he knows of ants that can do that. So thank you for calling. If you've got a question, our lines are now open. So 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. We've got some emails, Lisa. Mike in La Crosse emailed to say that a couple of weeks ago, he purchased a large, beautiful, and relatively expensive viburnum lantana called Moakin, that's it, at a local nursery and threw away the receipt. Now, last week he investigated the plant in more in-depth and was astonished to discover that lantana is considered an invasive species in Wisconsin and that this cultivar is apparently not nearly as aggressive but still a possible future problem. He says he can control it on his property, but he assumes birds will disperse the seeds wildly. Should he plant it or destroy it?
Oh, boy, that's a good question. I had not seen that viburnum lantana was on the NR40 list. If it's on the anything, though, that is on the DNR's NR40 list should not be planted and should not be sold. So I'm kind of questioning why, if the plant is on the DNR's NR40 list, then it, you would think the nursery would not be be selling it, unless possibly it is a seedless or a variety, or the variety doesn't produce viable seeds. So I don't know, Jill, whether you're Googling DNR
or and nothing is coming up. So that usually means it's not necessarily there.
It's so.
I mean, I know they were selling it here not too long ago, but
yeah, I'm surprised.
Things to get put on the list. There's a they call it the species. What's the acronym? It's SOG.
And yeah, it looks like it's might be more so in the Northeast and the Mid-Atlantic than it is here. Okay. So maybe that's
maybe that's where it's coming from. But that is a good thing to know. In environments similar to ours, that might be one that they're going to be evaluating. I don't know about Mohican in particular, whether that is one that, you know, doesn't have viable seed. But I guess I would, you know, since they're selling it here, it's not on the list yet. You could plant it, but it's something to think about for the future that maybe it will end up on that list.
Yeah, and I'm getting different things from, you know, it's all AI generated, so it's really difficult. But I don't see anything from the DNR in Wisconsin. So, yeah, Mike, maybe could you give them a call just to find out? Do they usually take calls like that?
If he wants to send me an email?
Yeah, or the DNR for that matter?
Yeah. You could send them an email. I believe there is a contact on the DNR's invasive species page. It's probably an email, not a phone
sure.
number, but
yeah.
I know they do answer questions.
Well, so that might be worth it just to see. So, yeah. Another email here. We've got Tom in La Crosse. He has two bushes of grow low sumac in the ground, and it's all sand and they're on a hill. Will the bushes make it, or does he need to dig them up and amend the and compost? He also has a Baptista that is blooming beautifully, but is totally sagging, flopping in the middle onto the ground on either side. What can he do to make it stand tall?
Okay, so let's talk about the sumac first. Sumac is pretty resilient. The grow low variety, I think it should do okay in sand. That being said, you're going to need to water it until it gets established. And also, if there's drought, I would certainly water it, but it can handle quite a bit of dry soil once it's established. Now, the Baptisia, if it is one of the hybrid varieties, they do unfortunately tend to flop. So I would use one of those support cages in the future. You know, the ones that kind of have a grid work of metal and it's round, so you get this round flat metal grid, and it gets you order it with legs of different sizes, and then you can when the plant starts to come up, you can make sure that the leaves and stems go in the right place. For now, you could at least stake the stems. I am kind of surprised if you've got it growing in sand, though. That usually tends to make them less floppy.
Well, he doesn't say that one is in sand, so it could be it's in a different place.
Yeah,
I don't know.
But it's unfortunately a rather common problem. We've had some in the teaching garden that have issues like that. The one that we have that is reliably upright is the Baptisia minor, and that one is a dwarf. And by dwarf, I mean it's still 4 feet tall, but it is reliably straight, and the flower panicles, while they're not as big, they are always upright. So that might be something to consider, either that or
boy, moving Baptisia is a difficult thing because they have a taproot that goes, you know, ridiculously deep. But if it's still movable and you have it in a less well-drained situation, I would move it if possible.
I've had pretty good luck with, I've got some Russian sage, the original one that was super tall and it always flaps over. So
yeah.
I usually cut it down probably maybe in July, beginning of July, and then it usually doesn't flap down as much.
Yeah, yeah. There is a horticultural procedure that they call the Chelsea chop. And that's basically, I know, of course, you have to have this fun marketing term. But basically what you're doing with a perennial is you're either pinching it back or cutting it back by about a third to a half before the 15th of June. So we've kind of missed that deadline. All right. Now, if they're up north, of course, they have, you know, more time to do that. But basically, it forces the plant to bush out and produce more stems, and it tends to be sturdier. However, I would not recommend that with Baptisia because of the structure of that plant. But you can get away with that with a lot of other types of plants, and the Russian sage being one of those.
Yes. We're talking with Lisa Johnson. She's a UW Extension horticulture educator for Dane County. What gardening questions are on your mind? Give us a call, 800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Hi, this is your weekly dose of gardening help, Garden Talk on the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau. Join us again on Monday. Our PT experts are back to talk about how much exercise you need to offset hours of sitting. And then we'll talk about how color can affect us psychologically. But first, let's go back to the phones. We've got Leo in La Crosse. Go ahead, Leo.
Hey there. I have a problem with Asian knotweed in my backyard. I just moved into a new apartment here in La Crosse, Wisconsin, and about a fourth of the yard was dominated by that, you know, Asian knotweed, the invasive species. And I've been, you know, trying to hand pull it out, and, you know, in a couple of days just grows right back. And I really don't know how to approach this. So if you have any advice, I'd really appreciate it.
Oh, Leo, I feel so bad for you.
Yeah, that is a really tough plant to get rid of. There really are not a whole lot of, non-herbicide options that work very well. For example, smothering or something like that doesn't tend to work terribly well. So you can, you know, you can continue to try digging, but the roots tend to be, I have a slide in an invasives talk that I give where it goes down like 30 inches. It's just really a horrible, horrible plant. So usually we do recommend different kinds of herbicides. I know that Mark Renz, our weed specialist, has a fact sheet on Japanese knotweed, which I was trying to locate here. I think it is on the Wisconsin horticulture site. And what it has is information on different types of herbicides and what to use at what time of year. I see I'm looking here at a different site, and it does, you know, give you some tips on which ones would be better and which ones would be worse. But it's a tough weed, not only because of the roots, but because it's got a waxy coating on it. So a lot of herbicides don't stick very well. What they do in England, actually, and this is really interesting, they cut it and they actually inject into the stem that, you know, nasty very robust inch diameter stem. They inject herbicide into that.
Wow.
It is on the DNR's NR40 list, so I do appreciate your trying to get rid of it, because it is an absolute scourge. And unfortunately, I mean, it's not being sold anymore, but it does manage to get around anyway.
I had some at the last place I lived. I've got some now at the new place. I'm so lucky. But the other place was horrible. And I think it took us, oh my gosh, 6 years before we actually got it in control. And it was just basically pulling and cutting. And then we did use some Roundup. We mowed it down. We pulled it. It takes time. And if you're going to do some the herbicides, we did it in the fall when all the energy was coming back in the roots. And that helped, but it's awful.
It's still, yeah.
It is awful. And it goes so fast.
Multi-year process.
Yes, for sure. So good luck, Leo. Next up, we have Mary in Fond du Lac. Go ahead, Mary. Mary, are you there?
Yes, I am. Are you there?
Yeah, go ahead. Go ahead, please.
Hello? Oh, hi. Because I have a philodendron, and you're going to help me pronounce this. Bye.
Oh, Mary, you are going in and out. You're fading in and out. That's why we're having a problem. It's a philodendron, and she wants to know, and she can't, why she can't divide it. Is that what you're asking, Mary?
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm sorry, Mary. Maybe try calling back and tell Joel what it is, and maybe he can just send it in. So let's go on to Bill in Bayfield. Go ahead, Bill.
Hi. I have two types of bushes that are struggling. I have a number of barberry that have been well established for a number of years. Some of them have not leafed out. Some have leafed out in sections or portions, but a lot of the branches are dead. Is there any hope?
Well, you might actually consider this a good time to consider another plant. If this is just the straight species Japanese barberry, it is on the invasives list and should be taken out. If it is one of the cultivars that is exempted, and you might want to look at the DNR NR40 list, then you can still grow it. I just took out some beloved, I had some Sunjoy Gold Pillar that is supposed to be seedless, or at least not produce many seeds. And I was taking off 100 seeds on each plant, and I took them out because we really can't have those getting distributed by birds. As far as the health though of those shrubs, there are some diseases that they are susceptible to, and when you mention them dying in sections, that makes me suspicious. It could be winter damage, but it could also be something like verticillium wilt. So you might want to contact Brian from the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic. But I would seriously consider this as an opportunity to plant a native shrub instead.
Bill, you had another question or another shrub that you were having problems with?
I have a fair, not as well established, maybe 3-4 years, English lavender, two cultivars of English lavender that had come back really well after the past winters, but this winter, they're not. Most of them have no leaf out. My question for you is, if I cut them off at the ground, is there any chance of them coming back, or do I give up on these too?
Personally, I would give up on them. Jill was telling me before the program started that she had lost some, It's a crop that is really difficult to grow in this state. We do have some lavender producers near Baraboo, near Door County, where they've got sand. And, you know, the lavender also is not reliably winter hardy past zone 5. There are some that are supposed to be zone 4. But I suspect what happened to yours is what happened to a lot of people's established and new plants this winter, was that we just didn't get enough snow cover and the cold really penetrated the ground. So if you're growing them in areas that are less than perfectly drained, I would either grow them kind of on a berm with some sand in it. But yeah, if you're not seeing any kind of growth yet, I suspect that they are unfortunately deceased.
Yeah, I still have mine in the ground too, Bill. I understand. I had two different varieties, and one variety is turning to green out a little bit, but the other one I think is trash. But I have to tell you, Bill, you're up in Bayfield. Now, I bought a lavender plant from, I can't remember the name of the flower or the greenhouse, but they're kind of up in the hill over Bayfield, and they've got that big barn. So I bought some from up there, planted them in the UP, and they are going gangbusters up there.
Oh, that's great.
So whatever they, you know, have there, that worked out great. So I don't know if you bought that yours there or not, but there are some varieties that, you know, they can survive. So good luck.
Yeah, especially when there's snow cover and good drainage.
Yeah, exactly. And this is right by my front step up there, and that's where all the snow gets pushed. So I think it kind of gets a little bit of coverage, you know, but anyway.
Yeah, but on the other hand, though, if you pile too much snow on it and it stays too wet over the winter, that's
very true.
Yeah. Well,
whatever it is, it's doing well so far. So
sorry, I've got nothing but bad news for you.
We want so badly to grow things that we really shouldn't be growing. We try everything, but generally, not so much. Now we've got to go in a little bit to the news, but Raquel had emailed us that they had problems with a plum tree that had plum borer. Now she's concerned about her peach and pear tree. Are they at risk from this?
There is a peach tree borer that is, you did say peach, right?
Well, they have a plum borer.
Yeah.
And then they have a peach and a pear tree that was in the same area.
I'm more worried about the peach because they are marginally hardy here and they typically aren't very long lived, but peach borer is one of the things that tends to take them out. And it tends to be a problem when they're under stress in particular. So like last year's drought is a problem. So they're both in the same, they're both Prunus. So they're both in the same genus. I'm not as worried about the pear. I am not aware of there being a pear tree borer. It's certainly possible. I'd have to check with our fruit tree specialist on that. But the peach definitely could be a problem. So definitely keep it watered and fertilize to the extent that you fertilize fruit trees, which is not very much, but some.
We tend to over-fertilize too, don't we?
Yeah, we do.
Yeah, for sure. Well, we are talking with Lisa Johnson. She's a UW Extension horticulture educator for Dane County. And she will be back with us after we take a break for the news. So if you've got a question for her, give us a call, 800-642-1234, or you can send an email to talk@wpr.org. Thank you. You're listening to Garden Talk on the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Najoe, and this is Wisconsin Public Radio. Lisa Johnson is back with us today, and she's answering all your gardening questions. She's a UW Extension horticulture educator for Dane County. In the last 30 minutes of the show, we'll talk to some folks from Breezy Hill Nursery about the firefly petunia. They had an event around this glow-in-the-dark plant, and it was a huge success, so we're going to find out what the fuss is all about. Next week on Garden Talk, Liz Fremont is back to talk about how to get your plants through the summer looking great. And then in the last 30 minutes, we'll talk about Japanese gardens and with the author of a beautiful new book. And I think I read that before, but we're going to go straight to the phone. Mary in Madison, go right ahead.
Hello. Yes, I was wondering to foster a prairie. This one man mentioned Baptiste.
Yes, go ahead, Mary.
Baptiste, I'm not saying it right, but I think in a prairie you wouldn't want to plant sumac if you were wanting to do that. Baptiste plant.
Okay. Well, there's two different types here we're talking about.
Yeah. Right? So I think, Mary, what you're talking about, Baptisia, that's a plant that's, it's an herbaceous perennial. It's in the legume family. And that is, we have, I believe it is, well, we have false indigo and we have the, a light colored one, and the name is escaping me right now. But those are good plants for prairies. Yes, I would not plant a sumac in a prairie because you'll have a sumac thicket. So I would definitely avoid that. Putting in prairie, like if you're reducing your lawn and wanting to put in some prairie plants. And by the way, I applaud doing that. Anything we can do to shrink our lawns and put in native vegetation will help our pollinators and the environment. But it's definitely an undertaking. Usually the first 3 years, you have to be really vigilant about weeding. And there are, you know, a couple of really good nurseries in the state, some really good providers. And of course, WPR has interviewed Neil Dybal many times. And so Prairie Nursery is one of the premier places that you can go to get different seed mixes and so on.
Okay, thank you, Mary. We wanted to talk about peach trees. Well, Jan in Viroqua has something that might coordinate with that. Go ahead, Jan.
Hi. Yes, I have a peach tree that's been in the ground 3 or 4 years. And last year and this summer, it has its leaves have curled and they get a kind of a coppery, almost luminescent tint to them. Any ideas?
Yeah. You and just about every other peach tree owner in the state seems to have peach leaf curl this year. It's a fungus, and it is pretty common on peach and nectarine. There's a related disease that affects plums. It's called plum pockets. But you do get this kind of puckered, sometimes pinkish, bubbly looking leaf growth. And the good news is that it's not going to kill your tree, but it does weaken it and make it more susceptible to, you know, peach tree borer and some other things. So you do definitely want to keep it watered and in good health so that it avoids stress. Now, there's nothing you can do at this time of year to try and mitigate that situation. But if you want to try and avoid problems with it next year, you can make a fungicide application after the leaves have dropped. So this is to the branches and the trunk, because that fungus overwinters in the bud scales and in crevices in bark. So after the leaves have dropped in the fall, or you can do it early spring too before the buds start to green up, but just to make sure you're going to avoid any kind of injury, I probably would do it late fall, like November or something like that. And you can use products that have copper, so Bordeaux mixture would work with that. Chlorothalonil is another one. And do make sure that the product that you choose is labeled for treating peach leaf curl. And that should help if you give it a thorough application. This is not one of those diseases, actually, that cleaning up the diseased leaves will help a lot. Not that it's a bad idea, but it's not one of those that's going to particularly help with.
Okay, again, that was peach leaf curl. Is there a reason why there's so much of it?
You know, that would be a Brian Huddleston question. Okay. I'm wondering that myself, because usually we see more of it when there's been a mild winter. And we didn't have a mild winter.
No.
So I'm not sure why, but boy, I've been getting a lot of questions about it.
Great. Well, good luck, Jan. At least you don't have to worry about it too much. So that's a good thing. You know, we were talking earlier, a couple of people called and said they were having problems with their seeds germinating in their garden. And Liz Fremont happens to be listening, and she sent me a message. And that she said that she has found that the use of Preen, which is the brand name for that seed abortive product, in vegetable gardens may have a multi-year negative effect on germination.
So if they were using Preen, and hi, Liz, miss you. Yeah, that could be too. And, you know, that kind of goes along with my supposition that maybe if he applied grass clippings as a mulch, that, you know, something like that could have also been treated. But that's really good to know. Thanks, Liz.
Yeah, for sure. I said, oh, that makes a lot of sense. So great. Mm-hmm. And I did manage well over the break. It looks like that the Viburnum lantana mohican is classified as prohibited in Wisconsin. So apparently it can start taking over the natives. So just as an FYI about that one.
Yeah, and that nursery should not be selling.
Yeah, and I mean, that's got to be something fairly new, because I haven't heard that before, but...
I hadn't either, yeah. But it's been in the last round of...
Right.
They have a species assessment group.
Right.
And they assess, they have a group that assesses herbaceous perennials and also one that does woodies.
Okay.
And they gather people from... You know, land managers, nursery people. It's a good selection of folks, and they look at the literature. You know, what's been happening in other states nearby, and they look at the history of the plant and its use, and then they make a recommendation as to whether or not the plant should go on either the restricted or prohibited list. I am surprised that it's prohibited is usually for things that are not well established here. Mm. And I remember selling that species, 20 years ago.
Yeah.
Well, actually more than 25. Yeah. I wasn't aware that one was still.
Well, Lisa, I'm very hurt because you did not send me a National Weed Your Garden Day card. Maybe it's in the mail. I don't know. We were talking about Preen and weeds and whatnot, but do you have a favorite method of controlling weeds?
It depends on the weed. If I had that Japanese knotweed that we were talking about, for example, that's...
You'd move, right?
Possible. Yeah. I did actually have somebody that claims he moved because of goutweed, not or bishop's weed. He had a running battle with that he kept me apprised on for a number of years. But yeah, there's some where I will reach for the herbicide, but most of the time I advocate pulling. You may be able to smother some things if they are not in an area that conflicts with anything else. But yeah, I wish there were some magic wand that, you know, we could wave and have it have things go away, but unfortunately not so much.
Well, let's go back to the phones. We've got Pam in Madison with a question. Go ahead, Pam.
Hi, thank you. I appreciate your program so much. I have two rose shrubs and the lower leaves look like skeleton leaves, but the rest above are all look healthy and I don't see any bugs.
Okay. What you probably have there is rose slug or pear slug. And they're not actually slugs. But for example, the pear slug has the delightful habit of piling its own excrement on itself as a camouflage and defense, because birds don't find that very attractive. The rose slug, and we do have, there's a bristly rose slug and the regular one. They're light green and they're pretty small. They've probably matured into pupa at this point. It's only the larval stage that does the damage. Usually it's going to be kind of minor or cosmetic damage and not all over the plant, but typically it will start on the lower leaves. I usually start scouting for it in early May to like the second week in May, because they blend in so darn well that it's hard to see that they're there, and then all of a sudden there's damage and you're like, wait a minute, where did this come from? But if you had them this year, they're probably going to be pupating in your soil, not necessarily around the rose plant, but probably. So you probably have missed your window to deal with them this year. They're easily squished. If you start scouting, you need to look underneath the leaf. So again, early May to the second week. And, you know, if you find any, that's a nice organic, well, maybe not nice, but it's an organic way to get rid of them. But at this point, the damage is done. The pest is gone. So I would just drive on at this point. You can pull off the affected leaves if you'd like to.
Okay. Thank you, Pam. Let's go to Appleton next. Dave, go right ahead.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I hope this call is appropriate. So I've got the invasive bamboo, and I've tried everything to get rid of it. I also have comfrey, and comfrey, the roots, I'm told, go down as far as 6 or even 10 feet, and there's no way I can kill these two. So I'm wondering if I use a glyphosate, I think it's 41% glyphosate, on these two, especially the comfrey and the bamboo that are just so hard to kill. Would that work?
It might. I'm pretty sure it'll work on the comfrey. That shouldn't be an issue. The Japanese knotweed that you're talking about, which is also sometimes called Japanese bamboo, it's unless you're talking about actual bamboo. Are you talking about actual bamboo?
Well, first off, the comfrey I'm concerned about because the root is so deep. But no, this is a bamboo. I don't have the name for it, but it's the worst you can get. Very invasive. And I don't know how to kill it.
Yeah. Well, the glyphosate should work on that. It may take a couple of applications, but if you do it before the leaves get hardened off, you know, while they're still actively expanding, that can help you. Also, if you do it in fall, when uptake is going to be the highest, that would be another strategy. But it should work. Be sure and use it as directed on the label, and wear whatever protective equipment it recommends.
Yeah, be careful with that, Dave. We've got a bunch of emails here. We're going to try to get to some of them. Remember Mary in Fond du Lac? She called about her philodendron. Apparently, a local floral shop told her she can't divide it, but she's had it for 47 years, and it's very root-bound. Philodendrons usually don't need to be divided, do they?
Not usually. Usually people will take stem cuttings right. From them, and they root very easily that way. I guess I'm not sure why she wants to divide it, but I'm guessing maybe it's outgrown its pot. And if that's the case, then you simply repot it with making sure that the new pot is no more than 2 inches in diameter, bigger than the old pot. You can divide it, but usually people just take cuttings, from it.
Yeah. So hopefully that'll help, answer that question for you. Kathy in Platteville called to say irises and daffodils, their fronds came up, but they haven't bloomed. And this has happened in the past 3 years. So what's going on? No blooms on her bulbs.
Okay. Sorry, I was still thinking about the other one. It just occurred to me, if it's a different type of philodendron than you and I are thinking of, if it's tree philodendron or it's one of the others, it would be more difficult.
Pipinate to Fidums. I've never heard of this one before.
Try that again.
P-I-P or B-I-P-I-N-N-A. T-I-F-I-D-U-M-S. Do you want me to use it in a sentence?
Bipinnativitis. That is not the one that's typically in hanging baskets. It may be that one is not something that you could divide.
Oh, yeah, that's a tree. That's a tree-shaped one with very ruffly leaves.
Yeah. Actually, if the caller, Mary, right?
Yeah.
If Mary could send me a photo by email, I can better advise her on what she has and whether, in fact, it can be divided.
That's amazing. 47 years. Those pieces are kind of pricky.
I was thinking the same, and it wasn't until after she hung up that I suddenly thought, what if it's not the species of philodendron?
Yeah, because that's what I was thinking, too. So, all right. Well, thanks for that insight. Now, let's get on to those bulbs that haven't bloomed for a couple of years.
Okay. And what type were they again?
She just said they were irises and daffodils, so time to dig them up and separate them.
Okay. So with daffodils and iris, if the bulbs are too crowded, or I should say rhizomes in the case of iris and bulbs in the case of daffodils. So both of them can be divided very easily in the fall. That's when you would typically do it. I would make sure to mark where the daffodils are so that when the foliage dies, you can find them again in September or so. Other than crowding, there are possibilities like they're in too much shade. That might be another thing that causes them not to flower. But if they're established plants that used to flower well, that would be my first guess. Mm-hmm. Overcrowding.
Or the tree that's close by is getting bigger.
Yeah, suddenly is. Yeah,
that happens. Let's go to Dave in Appleton. Go ahead, Dave. Yes, go ahead.
Hi, I'm trying to deal with invasive buckthorn in establishing a wildflower area. And it's city.
Okay, Dave, you're breaking up again, or another breakup. Not sure what's going on. Must be the weather. We'll blame it on the weather today. But it sounds like he's got a problem with buckthorn that's overtaking like a native area with
perennial garden.
Yeah, and everybody's got problems with buckthorn too.
Yeah,
There are several strategies that you can use. Certainly, if the plants are young enough, you can just pull them. If they are larger plants, you can cut down the stem. And there is a little device called a buckthorn baggie that was actually developed here in Wisconsin. And it's just a dark plastic bag that you put over the cut stump, and it prevents it from resprouting. And if you don't either apply herbicide or use something like the buckthorn baggie, it will resprout, believe me. So you want to make sure to, if it's a small area and you can use the buckthorn baggies, that's a great, not organic, it's a non-chemical method that can be very effective. If you have female trees that are producing fruit and seed, then you particularly want to get rid of them first. Sometimes people have issues with birds that have eaten buckthorn seeds, you know, from something nearby that's not on your property, and then sitting in the trees above your garden. And the buckthorn fruits have a cathartic effect, and so you get lots of bird poop and seeds in your garden area. Nothing you can do about that, but usually pulling or using the buckthorn baggies after you cut the thing down, or painting an herbicide onto the trunk after you make the cut. And if you do that, I probably would use glyphosate. I should let people know that the product that they're used to having glyphosate in, Roundup, generally no longer has glyphosate in it. It's triclopyr, and so that kills broadleaves, and then fluazifop for grasses. Triclopyr, unfortunately, stays in the ground a lot longer than glyphosate, and it is, I would say, more toxic. So I would not use that if it's in a garden setting. Ideally, you'd use the buckthorn baggies.
Okay.
That's not going to affect anything else.
Yeah, and sooner than later, Dave. So yeah, get up there definitely. And get at it. Well, 90 minutes is gone already, Lisa. Thank you so much for being with us. And I'm sorry we didn't get to a lot of those emails. But, you know, we're going to be here again next week. So give us a call then, and hopefully we can get to those. So thanks again, Lisa.
Thank you, Jill.
We have been talking to Lisa Johnson. She is a UW Extension horticulture educator for Dane County. Stay with us, because coming up in the next, for the last 30 minutes of the show, we're going to talk about petunias that glow in the dark. Well, would you stand in line to see a plant? A few weeks ago, gardeners did just that, and we'll talk about the plant and why people were so keen to see it at Breezy Hill Nursery a few weeks ago. With us from the nursery are Carrie Makris, the Garden Center Manager, and John Tarish, the Nursery and Retail Vice President. Have you seen the firefly petunia? What'd you think? Would you pay more for a glow-in-the-dark flower? Well, we'd like to hear from you, so give us a call at 800-642-1234, or, of course, you can send an email to talk@wpr.org. Hi, John. Thanks.
Hi, thank you for having me on.
You bet. And Carrie?
Yes, howdy. How are you?
I'm well. Thank you both for joining us. I know this is a very busy time for you, although I think in the landscaping business, you're busy all the time. So I guess it wasn't a perfect time to have you guys on. But John, why don't you tell us about Breezy Hill Nursery? How did it get started?
Sure. Yeah. Breezy Hill Nursery is a family-run business that's been growing, well, literally and figuratively for the last 45 years. We do a little bit of everything. We have a 1,200-acre nursery. We do landscape design, irrigation, even holiday lighting. But what we're really proud of is our garden centers, where we get to connect directly with the community. So we have two locations, one in Menominee Falls and our flagship location in Salem, which is where myself and Carrie work out of. A couple years ago, our founder, Jerry Epping, passed away in a motorcycle accident, and his son, Brad, stepped up and really took over the business. He brought me in with the approach to kind of revamp and rebuild the nursery and garden centers, and we were trying to become a destination for the community. So it's been exciting.
Wow, I'll bet. What a great job. Yes. Hey, you get to publicize us and get the word out and create all this cool stuff. Do you like going to work every day?
Oh, yeah. Every day is a little bit different, especially because I run a lot of the nursery stuff, too. So sure. I'm really bouncing around to different locations every day.
Well, Carrie, tell us about those retail locations. What exactly do you sell there?
So we sell about everything that has to do with gardening. Anything from annuals, hanging baskets, perennials, shrubs, trees, both bald and burlap tree, larger trees, as well as container trees. And we also have a greenhouse full of houseplants, as well as the interior of the store has all of like decorative tech things for your home. Again, geared towards gardening, garden flags, and also fertilizers and things like that to take care of the plants.
And I noticed you have a nice selection of pots too. Those are always fun to find.
Yes, we do. And I have a grand time ordering them all because I love pots.
I think we're all kind of a little addicted, right? Yeah. Even if it does, but it doesn't have a hole in it for water to go through. I don't care. I want it anyway.
Yep, that's right. We'll find a way.
Exactly. So what is it exactly that you do as the garden center manager then, besides ordering pots?
Well, I do a little bit of everything. From ordering plants, ordering houseplants. And I do a lot of the ordering for the merchandise in the store, inside and out. I also train and schedule all of the garden center personnel. I answer customers with questions and, help with sales and, plan for the future.
Well, that's true. That's important. You got to kind of look in your crystal ball. John, what do you do as the VP of Nursery and Retail?
So I'm a little bit more on the big picture, kind of looking at procedures and policies, as well as what we want the garden center to be, what we want our nursery to be, what we want our distribution center to look like. So a lot of what I do is put together plans and then go through and execute them. One of the main initiatives was to bring Carrie in. So Carrie's been with us for about a year. She's been absolutely wonderful in revamping a lot of that garden center work. And she really pulled a lot of work off of my plate, which I am thankful about.
Yes, it's always nice to have someone else that you can count on. One of the things that you guys have been trying to do is be something more than just the nursery tier or a gardening center for your communities. And you had this event at the end of May, but you centered it all around this plant. John, tell us about this petunia.
Yeah, of course. So the petunia is called Firefly Petunia. It's a newer release. So it got released limitedly last year, but this is the first year that we've expanded that out. So I've been very involved in American Hort, which is our national industry kind of community. And I made good friends with Susie Raker up at Raker Roberto Plants and Jennifer Moss at Moss Gardens in Idaho. And they were the first ones that got breeding rights to this plant. So what the plant is they basically CRISPR engineered, so genetically modified petunia plants, and they pulled the gene out of a fungus that is bioluminescent and put it into the plant itself. So the plant naturally produces, I think it's called luciferin. I could be getting the pronunciation wrong. And the plant will just naturally glow when it gets dark enough. And it's at all parts of the plant. It's most noticeable in the actively growing parts of the plant. So new flowers really, really look like little plugs of fireflies. So that's why they got the name that. But even the roots glow, there's a couple customers that have put the plants into like clear glass pots, and you can actually see the roots glowing a little bit. The stems will glow, the leaves will glow a little bit. So it's really, really neat.
Yeah, I mean, like you said, they just released these, so they're not everywhere. Have you all sold out so far or this year, or you still have some?
We still have some stock available, yes. We sold through a good chunk of them, but we still have some left. So that's been exciting. And then we were potted up some and made some bigger ones too.
And so like you said, it has to be dark. And these are not cheap, right?
No. No, it's a newer introduction, and the breeding rights are quite strong with them. So they're retailing for $35 mm-hmm. For a 5-inch pot, or we have some like 3 small ones. So if you're like a really, if you're comfortable growing plants, it's a little bit better deal because you get 3 plants, but then you got to wait the, we have like, I'm on a 9-week program. So it takes about 9 weeks to get them from the plug up into a 5-inch size.
Okay.
But so it was kind of interesting at the event too. Me, Carrie, and then the staff were all talking about like, oh, I think we're going to sell out of the smaller ones. People are going to be way more comfortable getting 3 small plants. And it was actually the opposite. It was true. Everybody wanted the full grown ones. They're like, we don't want to mess with it. We wanted the results. So,
Carrie, now, so why was this one your idea to create this event around this plant?
No, actually it was something that is asked of anyone who grows the firefly petunia. You know, to kind of help with the marketing and get the word out about this new plant. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, as soon as we started talking about it, I mean, we all started getting really excited about it and for it, and, you know, just of the possibilities of where this could go.
Yeah. So I heard that there was a line, like an hour wait to go into this tent with this plant. Is that right?
Yes, that is correct. There was some people, I think, who waited close to 2 hours to go through this tent that we had completely blacked out, so that there was absolutely no light, that they could go in, kind of let their eyes adjust into the one tent, and then they moved into the other room where the whole place was aglow. So it was something to see.
I'll bet that you must have been surprised by that.
Yes, we were.
But you had other things for them to do too. I mean, it was like a little festival, wasn't it?
Yeah, so we you know, because it's a glow in the dark, we decided to obviously have a ignite event. And so, you know, what better way to do an evening event than, you know, do it upright? And we had food trucks, we had a band, and then we also had some entertainers, jugglers, fire spinners, you know, so there was always something to watch, always something to do. I don't think anybody was, you know, just hanging out in the line being bored.
Sure.
So, and then of course, you know, there's always plenty to look at, and you know, lots of plants, you know, surrounding, you know, in the yard for the
sure. Shop. Sure. Now, you plan on doing this again next year?
Yes. The event was a huge success. And it was really the first event that we've put on. We were planning on somewhere between 1,000, maybe 1,200 people to come throughout the entire night. And we easily doubled that. So there was a little bit of planning stuff that needs to get worked out for our next event. Now that we have one under our belt. But I think we would all agree that it was a huge success in general. And what else was really nice about this plant is that it brought out a lot of non-gardeners. So a lot of people that traditionally wouldn't have gone to a garden center, because this is kind of new and different. We're the only country with it, and it's the first of its kind, that brought in a lot of people from surrounding areas. We had people come down from Appleton and Madison and up from Chicago just to see those. So it was really exciting to see everybody out that night.
Well, that's great, because I was wondering about that, if it was just gardeners or if it was just a lot of different people. Did you have to give a lot of instructions on how to take care of these plants to non-gardening people, or was it just gardeners buying it?
So we did actually give a handout of a little care instructions of the best, you know, for best results. You know, this is a plant that does like to be fed. So we also gave them a little sample packet of petunia fertilizer, as well as the brochure that says, you know, how to take care of it. You know, I think they even had on there how to best take a picture of it. You know, so,
sure.
So that they could be successful.
Excellent. Well, we are talking with John Terrish and Carrie Makris from Breezy Hill Nursery today. And we're talking about the glow-in-the-dark petunia, but then we're going to talk a little bit about some other things, too. We're going to take a little bit of a break. If you have a question for either one of them, give us a call, 800-642-1234, or you can send an email to talk@wpr.org. This is the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau. I hope you can join us again on Monday. Our TPT experts are back to talk about how much exercise you need to offset hours of sitting. And then we'll talk about how color can affect us psychologically. Maybe we should ask her about the glow-in-the-dark flowers and see how those affect us psychologically. But we're talking about that right now. And one question for you, John. Is there more plans in the future to grow different kinds of plants besides petunias that glow in the dark?
Yes. So the company that developed them is called Light Bio. And they release little sneak peeks and little previews of what's coming down the pipeline. I know that the next thing that's going to probably be released is an improved petunia. So this is the petunia we have is like a first generation petunia, and it's been bred and bred and bred for years and years and years into what you guys now purchase at a garden center, like Super Petunia and things like that. This is the very like parent plant of those. Plants that came out. So they're going to put this gene into like a stronger growing petunia. We grew all of our plants in the greenhouse, and it was a little touch and go at the front of it. We got it figured out, but we did a couple practice runs before getting our main supply in to start growing those up. So they're going to put it into an improved petunia. I've heard it glows brighter, it grows better. But then they also released some sneak peeks of some other plants with them, and that they're going to have to go through regulation before they get released. So it's going to be a little while. Mm-hmm. The newest one they put out was chrysanthemum, so mums that will have them. And we're really excited about that because if it glows at least in October, it's dark around 5 and not 10 o'clock at night. So that will be a nice one. And then they want to put it into house plants too. So things like porthos that hang and things like that, wow. Which will be really cool. We're one step away from living in Avatar, I think. So,
as long as you guys don't have to paint yourselves blue, I guess that'll be okay. So, tell us, you know, at the nursery, how much of the stock do you actually grow yourself, and how much do you order from other places, John?
So we try to grow everything we can. We have 1,200 acres. About 200 acres of that is container plants. We have a small greenhouse where we do a lot of our own annuals, and then we supplement buy-in of just things that we can't grow, or we do really what we're limited on is space. We're really a landscape wholesale for the nursery as our bigger production, and then Carrie brings in a lot of the color in from other vendors around the local area that are more specialized in that.
Mm-hmm. So, Carrie, what's blooming right now? What's the popular thing at your garden center?
Well, right now, anything blooming is of interest. the big one that people really been coming in and asking for has been, the peony, which, you know, of course is blooming everywhere right now. So
right.
About that. But I mean, it's, you know, we're kind of getting more towards the kind of the end of the annuals. Everybody's got their annuals in and baskets, purchased. So we're kind of in that mid section where we're moving from annuals, and more going toward the perennials as being the popular items. So.
Any new perennials that you're excited about, John?
Oh, newer perennials. Yeah, we're trialing a few things that we're excited about. There's a new butterfly bush that stays fairly short. And instead of like the long elongated flowers, they're like little tiny cones. We do a lot of trials in our nursery to for viability purposes or hardiness. So as we release those, it's quite exciting to kind of see the new stuff come through. There's so many new releases of different plants that we really kind of look at what's going to be hardy and what's going to grow really well in our area before moving them into the garden center.
And that's one of the pluses of going to a local garden center is that you guys have the knowledge about what's going to grow and what's not, and you don't really push anything that's not going to survive, right?
Right, yeah. Because we're selling to our local community, so we want to support that community the best we can. This winter was a really hard winter. A lot of losses, especially on the evergreen side, through the hard winter. It was really cold and no snow. So we're seeing a lot of people come in looking for replacements on things like that. And a lot of the times if they've gone through and tried to grow a plant that didn't survive, they want to stray away from it so we could help fill that area in. You know, we don't have to do a screen of all arborvitae. We could do a screen of a lot of different plants that would still give you that screen effect. So it's a lot of talking to customers and seeing what really they want and pulling that information out of them, because they know, they just don't have the vocab to really explain it. And that's what we're very good at.
That's very true. Carrie, I'm sure you run into that a lot in the garden center.
Yes, we do. We have a lot of first-time gardeners, a lot of long-time gardeners, but, you know, everybody's looking for, you know, the tried and true, you know, what can I put in my garden that I don't have to worry about, that is hard to kill, both new gardeners and experienced gardeners want that. I want that too. But it is a lot of, just talking with them about, you know, the space that they have, the sun that they have, and what they're looking for. And then, you know, we kind of direct them to those plants that fit the bill. So.
Invaluable advice for sure. Do you have any other events coming up in this summer, Carrie?
So we do workshops here in the greenhouse. In the back of our greenhouse, we have like a little class space where we do anything from, we do a wide variety of things. We do some dried flower, like pressed into a frame. We do just potting up an annual planter. At Christmas time, we do porch pots with, the birch poles. We do a hydrangea wreath also. So with semi-dried hydrangeas. So that's always a popular one as well. So there's kind of always something going on. Mm-hmm. So right now we have two classes going on a week. And then usually in the winter, we kind of bump that up a little bit just because people are looking for something to do and, you know, get their hands in the dirt. Everyone wants to get their hands in the dirt, even in December and January. So we try to do as much as we can there. So.
For sure. Now, you do residential landscaping as well as for companies and things, John. Excuse me. What have you seen trend-wise in landscaping in the last few years?
So for the most part, what we're seeing is newer homeowners that want to revamp their front yards. We call them foundation plantings. So they're buying a new house. A lot of time it's fresh build, new builds, where they haven't put the money into the landscape side for the builders. So they're coming to us with almost blank slates in general. Wanting to refresh and kind of give a more neighborhood feel into their new homes. There's a few people that come in looking for revamps of, oh, this landscape's been planted for 30 years. We're looking for something new. But for the most part, we're seeing more of a trend on kind of newer newer homeowners come in and looking for design ideas.
Mm-hmm. What about hardscaping? What's popular these days with their patios or our deck? Patios kind of outshining decks these days?
Yeah, it really seems that way. Paper patios are kind of the what most people are asking for. And with modern pavers, man, they come in every shape and size and color. And you could do old world looks, new world looks, modern, you know, post-contemporary. There's so many different design choices that you could do. And everybody's got kind of a different feel, and it goes off of what their house looks like and what they're looking for, what their design preferences are.
Mm-hmm. What about kitchens, outside kitchens? Have you gotten any of those?
Yeah. I mean, that's still really popular. So outdoor grills, outdoor patios. So one of the things we did in our garden center is we put up, was it nine? You could correct me on the number, Carrie. Nine different show gardens that we placed, one of them being an outdoor kitchen. So we did the hardscapes, and our design build crew built up an arbor and put in the refrigerator and a grill, and it's all hooked up. So we're going to do a few events in that area, grilling up some burgers and brats and stuff on the weekends to showcase that. But the other gardens are all, we have four themed ones. We have a music garden. We have a fantasy one, which is fun, with dragons and glowing eyeballs. It's pretty wild. We have a Western garden with a very large boxwood bowl. So it's been fun, and it's great to just come out and walk them and kind of get some design ideas.
Yeah, that's a great idea. I'm sure people do appreciate seeing them put together. It's a lot different than seeing them on a piece of paper. Right?
Oh, yeah. Once you actually see it, it's when you look at a landscape design, it's really hard to visualize it. I mean, I've been in the industry for about 20 years, and I still have a hard time going like, well, what's this really going to look like? So to actually see them out there is impressive.
Definitely. So, Carrie, do you are you a gardener at home, too? Or do you just save it all for work?
Well, I am a gardener at home. I don't garden quite as much as I'd like to, because I am here a lot and doing a lot of the same things. But yes, I am a gardener at heart. And so I love to come to work and, you know, talk to people who love flowers and love plants. And they also, you know, want to talk flowers and plants. And so we have a good time.
Absolutely. Well, we do that here every week, so we can appreciate that. What about you, John? Do you have time to do landscaping around your house?
I feel like I'm more of a chef that makes grilled cheese at home. and it started to get to the point where it got a little embarrassing. So I did start gardening this last year. I've been in my home for 4 years now, and I'm just getting around to the front yard. So I put in a nice little design right by the front door, and I am mulching this weekend. And I'm getting the mulch on. So,
oh, that's wonderful. Oh my gosh. So you had mentioned that you guys do holiday lighting. So how did you come to do that?
How it came to be is that customers were just asking for it. So we were doing some higher end homes, and we were doing all the maintenance work. So mowing the lawns, badge edging, and holidays came around, and there was an opportunity to do that. And we did. So one of the flagship pieces at Breezy Hill is we have it's got to be about 60 feet tall tree, and we cover it in blue lights, and it's been lit for the last 20 years.
Oh my gosh, and, that's great.
We'll be out at a restaurant or something like that, and people will come up and go, well, I knew Christmas was coming because the blue light turned on, or the blue tree turned on.
Oh, that's wonderful. And we've got to wrap things up real quick, so I want to thank you very much. And what is your website real quick, Carrie?
Yeah, our website is breezyhillnursery.com.
All right. Thank you for John and Carrie from the Breezy Hill Nursery, and we'll see you all next week. Thanks for joining us.